Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of In the Round. We hope you're doing all right out there. We're finally starting to see some light through this pandemic and stuff. And before we get right into the show, let's jump over and check in with my main right-hand man, my co-host, the former host of an international House of Pies, Mr. Lee Tonin. Lee, how you doing today?
You gotta love them pies. We bring them up nice and bright, shiny, apple, cherry, and chocolate.
International House of Pies, not to be confused with the International House of Pancakes.
I thought you were going with the pancake thing. That's the only international
today.
I know.
No, not today.
Well, you know what really grinds my gears? Yeah. Why don't they have the syrup on the table at IHOP anymore?
Well, because of COVID, man. And, you know, I think that was a thing before this, too.
I know, but I ate there a couple days ago.
And they didn't have it anymore.
No,
huh?
Because that's what my favorite thing was, is you could always decide.
Blueberry,
you
strawberry.
Had to make a decision on the fly, saying, well, nowadays they just bring you some syrup, and they're like, here's what you get. Sorry.
Yeah, it's kind of.
Like, I don't think I like that.
Yeah, so, man, where have you been? We've been off for a while.
It's been a couple weeks since we've been here. I had to do some traveling for work.
That's right.
And then
you went down towards the border.
I was down in El Paso, Texas, in Carlsbad, New Mexico. Right on the border there. I mean, it's hard to tell where the border ends and the United States begins, but man,
over
it was
in
good.
That part, yes, definitely. No offense to anybody that lives there or anything.
No, not at all.
You guys rule if you're tuning in.
A border city, it's kind of strange, man.
But yay, thank you for tuning in. Let's get right into it here. We always have a funny news segment or whatever, so cue that news music. The first headline here reads, $46,000 in cash found under floorboards of Massachusetts home. So on April 22nd, a Massachusetts family hired a professional treasure hunter to investigate a decades-old rumors of money hidden in their home. And he discovered that there was $46,000 hidden under the floorboards of their home. So Keith Willey of Groton, Connecticut, said he was contacted by a Western Massachusetts family who will remain nameless, obviously.
Anonymous.
Yes. So this Massachusetts family told him about the rumor of a large sum of money that was supposed to be concealed in their home sometime in the 1950s. The family said they hired carpenters to look inside the walls and underneath the floors in the past, but no trace of the rumored cash was ever discovered in the past. So Willie said that he also took his metal detector into the house and into the attic and everything, and it signaled there was something underneath the floorboard. And he took a, you know, what are those, what do they call those, endoscopic cameras?
Yeah, yeah.
That go like inside of things, you know, they can go in tubes and stuff like that and all that. So
usually
they did
those
that.
Those are people's buttholes.
Yeah, or down your throat or whatever.
Throat,
yeah. You know.
They use those a lot. Video
absolutely,
images
yeah.
in
totally.
Sewers and stuff, too.
Totally, yeah, to see if there's any blockages or anything.
It's easier, it's safer than putting a man down there.
Yeah, so anyways, they used one of those cameras, and it revealed a metal box hidden under the floorboards. Willie and the family pulled the floorboards up and opened the box to discover $46,000 of cash wrapped in the original bank straps dating back to the 1950s. And
awesome.
A family member who identified herself as Karen said the discovery came after many years of wondering if the story of the money were actually true, you know, of the hidden money.
I guess they get to keep it, right?
Yeah. No, and they said they were just glad it was finally found, and they haven't decided what they were going to do with the discovered cash.
It was 46 grand?
I would hold on to some of the old money.
Well,
it looks cool.
Yeah, in the 50s, that would be, I don't know what it would be equivalent to, but I bet it'd be equivalent to probably a couple hundred grand.
I wonder what was, how they received
it. Yeah, that's what I'm wondering.
Was it ill-gotten money?
Was it, part of a heist or something like that? Or,
yeah, because that was a lot at the time.
Yeah, I mean, or, you know, who knows? I mean, that would be neat if they could follow back and say this
gambling
is
gambling winnings or something.
Who knows? Whatever it was probably never declared.
No, totally, yeah.
You know?
But, that's not something I don't know if I would go to the news with, you know? It's like, hey, check this out, you know, because they probably wouldn't want to tax you on that.
Of course they would, yeah. It's income, yeah. I wonder if they have any problems, because, you know, the bills look different now.
Yeah. So they're trying to get new ones
or
whatever.
I guess
you
could take it to a bank and say, I want to exchange this
for
current currency.
This is what
happened, yeah.
I'm sure they can do it.
Oh, yeah. I know
I'm
the
sure
bills are still good.
To. Yeah.
I don't think bills ever go bad.
Yeah.
Like, hey, these aren't acceptable.
I found this in my grandfather's house.
Yeah.
And
like, if you had a bill from, say, like the 1800s or
something.
Because
that's happened to me before, buying a book at a yard sale and a couple old 20s fell out or whatever. And it was like, I mean, they were old for the time. They were from the 70s or whatever.
Yeah, I remember that.
So, I mean, that's kind of interesting. I wonder what the largest amount's ever been found like that. Because I know there's been stories of, like, putting on a jacket at Goodwill and buying it and finding, you know, money
I've
in
done
the pocket.
It. I've done
stuff.
It with my own clothes.
Yeah.
You know, I'll put a pair of clothes on, I'll reach in the pocket and find a bill or something. Yeah.
Taking clothes out of the dryer and find a couple bills.
Oh, yeah. Dryer money's the best money.
I don't know, though. I'm pretty, you know... I watch my money pretty closely.
Yeah, I usually keep my money in my wallet, dude. So it doesn't. Yeah, I don't usually keep it in my pockets. So.
And organized and stuff.
You know? I'm just. It's just the way I am, man.
So, moving right along to the next story here, and this has a really cool headline. This happened on April 21st, and the headline reads: "Message in a bottle travels 250 miles from Kentucky to Tennessee in 30 years."
That's called taking the slow boat to China,
right,
man.
Right. So on April 21st, a message in a bottle dropped into the Kentucky River was found 30 years later after floating an estimated 250 miles to Tennessee. Pam Stanfield said her husband Daniel and daughter Skylar May were out treasure hunting on the shore. Oh, wait, back this up for a second. Why? What, the last story just had a treasure hunter in it. Now this one's got a treasure hunter in it.
Well,
what kind of treasure are you looking for? Well, declare what treasure is.
You got these people that like to go out and do that.
I get it. You know.
With the COVID being what it is,
it's kind of interesting.
Outdoorsy, and it's solitude. And
it's very cool. Father-daughter team goes out treasure hunting on the shore of Open Lake near Ripley, Tennessee. After recent flooding, when they discovered the bottle with a message inside. This is quoted from Pam Stanfield saying, "Most of the time it's a bunch of trash, but every now and then you get something neat." And they got something neat this time.
It's just amazing that it took 30 years for it to go 250 miles. It seems like you could do that in a few days.
Oh, easily, especially with some current or whatever.
I wonder what the backstory of it is.
The rest of the story goes, the note inside the bottle was signed John and Trina and said the message was launched into the Green River on December 21st, 1990. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a long time ago. But the bottle had apparently traveled 250 miles through the Green River, the Ohio River, and the Mississippi River before ending up in the lake.
Huh.
So it had to go through all that. I've been down the Mississippi. It is massive. It is huge. Oh,
yeah. Absolutely.
And so Pam Stanfield said her Facebook post about the discovery had been up for less than an hour before she was contacted by Trina Hollander, the original...
She's still alive, huh?
Yeah, people that put the bottle in the water. Trina said, "I was getting calls from my son and another friend asking if I checked Facebook in the last little while, and I hadn't. And, they told me to go check it out, and I couldn't believe it when I saw it, as a post on Facebook." That's the thing about social media. It could be used for something cool when it needs to be.
Oh, absolutely.
Very cool. Something positive.
It's got its perks.
Here and there. Absolutely. Aside from all the negative stuff that comes along with it. But, Hollander said she didn't remember putting the message into a bottle and into the river, but her husband, John, recalled the event right away. And the couple said they weren't yet married, but had just moved into the home on the shore of the river when they launched the bottle.
Huh.
So it was kind of like
I wonder if they're still there.
Yeah, I know, right? So the two families said they plan to keep in touch, and they've made new friends with each other. So, that's pretty cool.
Remember that time you found that bottle I put in the river? That's all we have in common.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So a while back, recently... in Nova Scotia, Canada, a boy recently made a similar discovery in his parents' backyard and found a message in a bottle under a tree. And the bottle had been sitting there for 25 years and was dropped off by a 14-year-old girl visiting that area at the time with her family.
How did he find it? He just dug it up or something?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Kind of crazy. Yeah. I always thought that's cool, like those time capsules that schools used to do and stuff, hey, we're going to open this up in 100 years.
I remember doing time capsules when I was in school. I just never got around to ever going. I wonder whatever happened, you know?
If they actually opened them.
I'm sure someone did eventually, yeah.
Yeah, totally. I like when people do that, too, when they're like remodeling the house or whatever. They always leave something creepy or whatever
something
stupid.
Well, have you ever seen the movie Hard to Kill with the great Steven Seagal in it? He leaves his movie camera in his old house that has the evidence to convict the bad guy.
Okay.
You can quote Steven Seagal on any topic
in most life events. Yeah, yes,
because he's done everything.
We love you, Steven. Please come on the show. We know you've been out here in Arizona, man. Do you have a house?
Yeah,
he has a house here for sale. We kind of like to buy it too. That'd be cool.
Yeah, I need about $3 million.
But hey, come out here, Steven. Come on the show, man. Seriously. If any of you out there have any leads on that, let us know.
Yeah, I don't know if I told you this.
You got any leads?
I've been doing podcasts now for like 37 years.
He would be a kick-ass guest. You're blowing the shots for us right now, man. Like,
that's doing that.
He's going to come down here and kick your ass.
Well, he's already here. He heard his name. He's already here.
Yeah. Moving right along here to our next story. And this is pretty funny because this story involves a sports car. And to me, it looks like a Corvette from here, but it's kind of hard with the crop picture to tell. Headline reads, "Firefighters rescue dog alone inside moving vehicle." So on April 21st, the firefighters in Canada came to a rescue of a dog who knocked their owner's vehicle out of park and took an accidental joyride. The Edmonton Fire Rescue Service in Alberta said a crew was summoned about 12:30 in the afternoon on Tuesday when witnesses reported a dog was alone inside driving a vehicle rolling down Guardian Road.
That'd be badass.
You've got to see this picture, dude.
Yeah. I've seen it. I've seen that picture. Yeah,
that is
badass.
Crazy, dude. It has some kind of sports car, too. So the personnel said the dog had been left alone in the car, and it appears that the dog had popped the car into neutral, causing it to coast, you know?
It was probably a stick shift or something.
That's what I'm thinking, yeah. And the guy didn't have the e-brake on, right?
Or something, yeah.
You know, maybe. That's the only thing I could think
of. Yeah, I can't see how a dog can knock a car out of park.
Well, especially in automatic. Like, you have to pull the fucking selector.
And you have
stuff,
to hold your foot on the brake. So,
I mean, that would be the only thing I could think of.
Huh. I bet he was mad.
The dog was successfully rescued, and there was no injuries or anything like that. Just kind of a funny story.
The car get damaged?
No, he didn't crash or anything. They got it stopped in time and all that, so pretty interesting.
Yeah,
you
that'd
know.
Be fun to see.
But to drive by and you see a dog in the driver's seat with no one in it. Yeah, see, and that's the thing with self-driving cars. You're probably going to see stuff like this going on.
I've been told, I don't know if it's true or not, but I've been told now we can go to Tempe.
Yeah.
And we can actually get a self-driving.
Yeah.
Like, it's Waymo or Vaymo or something like that now. And I go, but is it a person in the car? They're like, no, this car is completely
that's crazy
by itself.
I've seen Domino's deliver pizzas like that.
See, I've never seen one of the self-driving
those
cars without somebody in it.
No,
without somebody in the driver's seat.
I've seen them drop off pizzas like that. It has a little side hatch that opens up on the side.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Yeah.
Here in town, you've seen it?
In Vegas.
Oh, okay.
They give you a little PIN code that you punch in when the car pulls up, and you punch in the PIN on your phone, and the fucking little cubby hole opens up
and you grab
your stuff out. Yeah,
it's
kind of cool because then there's no react, like, you know. I don't know how the drivers feel about that.
I don't know if I like all this like self-doing stuff.
It's kind of crazy.
Well, you know what always happens in these situations is the machines learn more than human.
They revolt.
And then they turn on you.
You know, I would say like Maximum Overdrive, but they kind of botched that and made it into an alien thing.
Yeah, but I'm just talking about the machines in general just quit listening to you.
Yeah.
You know?
All right, moving right along here. Let's get out of the sci-fi area here. What is this, the Twilight Zone? Moving right along into the last story of the news segment before our break. Headline reads, world's highest infinity pool is nearly 1,000 feet off the ground.
Jesus.
You've seen infinity pools
before,
right? They're awesome.
Yeah, they usually have them on top of buildings and stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah, where it looks like it goes off the edge.
So as you can guess, the world's tallest one, highest one, is going to be somewhere totally awesome.
Probably Dubai?
Exactly.
Yeah, I was going to say Dubai or Hong Kong.
Yeah, so on April 15th, a resort skyscraper in Dubai broke a Guinness World Record for the highest outdoor infinity pool at 964 feet and 2 inches above ground level.
Woo.
So Guinness said the Address Beach Resort, a recently completed skyscraper in Dubai, now a world record holder after an infinity pool was installed on the 77th floor rooftop. Now, just as an example, the Cosmopolitan in Las Vegas is 75 floors at the very top, the tallest tower is. So that's pretty crazy. That's where the pool just sits. Then there's the whole rest of the tower.
In Dubai.
Yes.
The overall height of the Cosmopolitan is 75 floors,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Well, they don't build the skyscrapers as tall in the west of America than they do back east.
No, totally. It's crazy, man.
Yeah.
But the pool has surface area of more than 6,000 square feet and is about 4 feet deep at its deepest point.
Have you seen those one pools on the internet you see every now and then that are built like off it, like they have glass bottoms and they're like
they're
in the
fucking nuts, dude.
Yeah, and you could be up, you know, 30, 40 mm-hmm. floors and the pool's got a glass.
They look cool.
I don't know if I'd get in that, man.
I would. Just
I don't know.
I would briefly.
I don't know.
Not for long. I'd be like, I got in for 5 minutes.
Yeah,
and
I don't
out,
know.
Dude.
I don't know.
Make you feel uneasy?
Well, I don't do heights real well.
I don't know if you got to die that way, you die that way. You know what I'm saying?
I just think, what if the pool breaks or something and you go
for it? What are you going to do?
Yeah,
swim your way out?
It would be.
You can't outswim the fall, dude.
Yeah, I don't, you know, you could avoid it by not getting in it, man.
Oh, totally, 100%. It's the same thing, like they have those glass slides in the side of skyscrapers and stuff that go from one floor to the next. On some buildings, they have those, dude.
I've never seen that.
Fully encased glass slides. They're like little attraction things, dude.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
and
that'd
like,
be kind of neat.
It's the same thing. Like, what
See,
if? What
I
if?
Wouldn't ride any of the rides.
But if you live your life, like, they will never do anything
no,
cool.
No, but when we lived in Vegas, and I was tricked into going on that space shot that time.
Yeah.
And then I would never ride it again.
So check this out. That same building that has this infinity pool was also awarded another record from Guinness for having the highest occupiable sky bridge floor, which is 965 feet and 8.4 inches over the ground.
Jesus.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy, man.
Yeah,
that's
they got some neat stuff over there.
Well, right? Yeah, just in general. Like, When you think of the future and the way you think cities should probably, like, building and architecture should look, they really do.
Hong Kong, too.
Yeah, they're really on that
level. On the cusp or whatever, yeah.
So as far as, like, the Jetsons looked and stuff like that.
Which I think that if they get that going in America, you know,
yeah.
I think that'd be kind of neat. Because our cities, I mean, are beautiful, but, I mean, they are looking aged. I mean,
absolutely. So we're going to go off to our first break here, everyone, and we will be right back with more of In the Round. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. All right, you know what time it is. We're going to jump right into Just the Facts. And, you know, we're kind of throwing it back to the original episodes here with Just the Facts on this episode, because we know for the last few topics that we've done on our show, the Just the Facts segments have been pretty much related to the topic of the day. But we're not going to do that this time. We're kind of going to go back to the old way of doing it and doing some random facts, just off-the-wall stuff that we grabbed and out of, you know, everyday life, just totally random. So we're going to start off here with the first one. And this is a very interesting fact, because I've been having trouble with my key fob lately. I think I need a new one for my car to unlock the car.
Maybe the battery's going dead.
Yeah, that too. I just think the contacts are just not touching and stuff like that, so it's probably time for a new one. But this first fact reads, if you point your car's keys to your head, it increases the remote signal range. And this works by using your brain to act as a radio transmitter.
Okay.
Swear. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, I guess.
No, I swear it really works, dude.
I guess we'll have to give that a try.
No, I've seen it, man. I swear. Look it up on YouTube.
What if it unlocks your head, though?
Yeah. Your head just falls back.
Or what if, yeah. Bro, people used to pick in their ears with their keys. I'd be like, what are you trying to do? Start your head?
Yeah. I'm trying to get an idea here. Hold on. All right. Moving right along to the next one here. You know Jack Daniel's, the whiskey.
Absolutely. I've been heard of it.
Well, the founder, Jack Daniel, died from kicking a safe. Did you know that?
I never heard this story. He died from kicking a safe.
Kicking a safe.
Broke a foot or something.
When he kicked it, he broke his toe, which then got infected, and he died of blood poisoning.
Oh, yeah. At what year?
I don't have the year on hand.
Oh, okay.
But
yeah, that killed a lot of people.
You gotta think it had to be in the 1800s, right?
Yeah. Yeah. My grandfather died of tetanus.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Would he kick it? Did he kick a safe?
No, he stepped on a rusty nail or something, man.
Gotcha.
And back then, you know, this was back along, you know, we didn't have a tetanus shot.
Yeah,
and you end up getting lockjaw and dying.
You just died,
man. Yeah.
Yeah, so you got
Well, you remember
infected.
What was that thing? It was, hey, a cut like this is a death warrant.
They weren't wrong about that. I mean, realistically, that's true.
Yeah, yeah, dysentery, mm-hmm. tetanus,
yeah.
That stuff killed a ton of people. You know, you had to be, think about how rough life was back then.
Oh,
man.
Yeah, especially, you know.
You know, and so it didn't take much.
Guys, that was 30 years old, look 65 years old.
If you lived to be 65, you were old.
Ancient.
Yeah, I mean, I think the average death, I think people died in the average of the mid to late 40s, early 50s, dude.
So this next fact here that we're going to go into is, I specifically grabbed this one because of the whole pandemic thing that we've all just recently kind of gone through, and it's not over by any means and stuff, you know what I mean?
It's looking it's better
starting
in, our,
to subside
in our country.
Somewhat, for us, yeah. Exactly, you know, and
it's devastating in
thankfully,
other parts of the world, yeah.
Thankfully, I mean, whether you want to get vaccinated or not, that's your choice,
yeah,
and
absolutely.
I think everyone should be taking the precautions now from this point on. That we weren't taking in the beginning, so...
Oh, I think,
you know.
I think America's done a pretty good job.
No, and I think it really opened your eyes to how many people weren't washing their hands,
yeah,
man.
It does. It's
just wash your hands, guys.
Thing that you go, hey, man, I'd like to wash my hands and
stuff
like that.
You know? Like how many concerts I went to where guys would just walk out of the bathroom and not wash their hands after going to the bathroom.
Well, I have a theory about that, man.
I get it.
I don't know if washing your hands in a place like that is any better than not washing your hands.
I don't know, yeah. I don't really know,
because they're so dirty, man.
Yeah,
it's just, you know.
There's so many people and stuff.
Yeah, so, I mean, I just, you know, just don't touch touch me if you're going
to
do that.
So moving right along to the next fact, the Black Death killed so many people in the 14th century that the world population did not recover to pre-plague levels until the 17th century.
Yeah, I've heard that.
That is insane. Yeah. That's how many people it actually infected.
What did we just pass? 3 million people worldwide that have died from this.
So comparison...
You know, it's all a matter of theory.
I get what you're saying. Yeah, you know, and there's billions of people
on this planet. Man.
No, I know, and that's what I mean. It's
the thing is
the numbers aren't as bad as you would think.
Well,
you know?
The thing is though is if you lost somebody to COVID, it's devastating. So you don't give a shit what the math says.
And
man.
I agree on that part, but yeah. You know,
it's, oh no, I agree.
Numbers are numbers, man.
You know, I don't you know on a different subject. I don't think we handled it right from the beginning, man. No, that's just my opinion.
No, absolutely not. So moving right along here into another fact, you like cartoons, I like cartoons.
Who doesn't like cartoons?
Yeah. So Hanna-Barbera, legendary production company, team, Yogi Bear. You know, yeah, they made everything. So Hanna-Barbera pitched the Flintstones to TV networks for 8 weeks before it was ever even picked up. And when it was picked up, it was the first ever animated show to air during primetime television.
I remember hearing that, yeah. I can see why the Flintstones would
I'm
going
to say that was in the mid-50s. It had to have been.
But I can see why the Flintstones would have been a hard sell.
Yeah.
Because you're talking about in the 50s, the country was a lot more conservative then.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it wasn't as, you know.
It was a cartoon.
It was a cartoon to where most adults probably didn't watch cartoons.
No, at all.
You know,
Not like today where it's normalized.
Yeah, I mean, if you were a 30-year-old guy watching cartoons, you were probably considered a bum.
A weirdo, yeah.
You know, it was a different time, man.
No, absolutely.
And so I could see where whoever was trying to pitch it, saying, look, we're going to put this on at 8 o'clock at night.
7 p.m. in everybody's living room.
Because I've never been the biggest Flintstones fan in the world. Yeah. I think the best thing that came out of the Flintstones was their cereal.
Okay.
But I don't hate them. I never cared for Fred Flintstone. He's a hothead.
Yeah.
You know, but I can see where the show...
Hey, Barney.
Well, I got an eruption. I can just see where, like, the show, to me as a little kid, it was never very appealing to me because it was geared up for adults.
No, totally. That makes sense,
you know,
too.
Yeah. So you could say that the Flintstones were basically a precursor to the Simpsons
Oh, totally. Absolutely.
Because I remember Wait Till Your Father Gets Home.
Which was the same kind of show.
It was kind of a Simpsons before the Simpsons was on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know?
And I think that was Hanna-Barbera, too.
Yeah, and didn't it have Tom Bosley on it?
It had the guy that played Mr. C from, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and then a crazy, like, right-wing nutcase neighbor. And
so, moving on along to our next fact here. This is out of Beijing. So, there are 10,000 underground nuclear bunkers in Beijing built during the Cold War. They were later sold as real estate and are currently inhabited by 1 million people.
Jesus.
Is that nuts?
You know, you can buy them here, too.
Yeah.
You can buy old silos.
That's pretty cool.
Where we used to keep nuclear weapons. Yeah. You can buy them and convert them into houses or do whatever.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Underground home.
Yeah, that's, you know, America in the Cold War era, you know, I lived through it. So, yeah. I mean, you know, until when it ended in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
you know, but suppose I don't think it ever really ended, man. I think it's just been, we're seeing it again now.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, people built bomb shelters, and they built, you know, we were pretty much sure that this was going to happen.
At
some point it was going to happen.
Someone's going to launch one of these.
Yeah, and it still could.
Absolutely.
The likelihood of it happening now is probably higher than it's ever been.
Yeah.
And just in the world, because there's more people that have weapons
now. Well, it's just
now.
One giant Mexican standoff, too. So.
Yeah, and that was the whole point to have nuclear weapons, is that if I have them and you have them, neither one of us are going to have the guts to use them.
Yeah, exactly.
It was peace by strength,
yeah,
is what it was
exactly,
called.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
But yeah, I would love to go take a tour of an old silo or something like that. That'd be neat, because I'm sure there's a ton of them in the Soviet
Union. Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
Too.
I just thought that was really interesting, and that's a lot of people, because there's only 10,000. That's a million people that are living within those 10,000.
Well, China's got nothing but people.
Oh, I know. Remember all those bicycles we saw sitting there?
Oh, yeah, it's crazy.
It is nuts, man. Crazy. Melt those things down.
Yeah, I don't know what they
were
doing
to them
all.
You know? Moving right along here, next fact. This goes to show you how crazy Mother Nature is and stuff like that, just how nature in general can be. So a bolt of lightning can reach up to 54,000 degrees Fahrenheit. That is 5 times hotter than the surface of the sun, which is actually 10,340 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's still pretty warm.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm just saying. Isn't that nuts?
When, in that quick instant, that's how hot.
Remember we watched that video of a guy getting hit by a random strike?
Oh, yeah.
And He wasn't even, he didn't get hit by it. He was just near it and happened to be touching a trailer and it ground out. You know?
Knocked him out.
Yeah, it was intense.
Yeah, I think a direct hit of lightning basically kills you, man.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know? If you survive, that's amazing.
Yeah, 1.21 gigawatts.
Yeah, so I thought that was pretty crazy. Here's the next fact. We're getting ready to wrap up this segment of the show. Employees at Miller Coors, the beverage company, the beer company, get 3 free cases of beer each month. And in addition to having access to beer on location after a work day.
Well, of course they should.
That's freaking awesome, man.
Hey, they make 35,000 bottles of beer in there a day. And they get on my ass for drinking 15 or 20 of them at lunch. I don't know what their deal is.
That's cool, though.
Yeah,
man.
Somebody died up at the brewery that day. Me.
So, I thought that was cool, man. 3 cases is a lot every month. Every month.
I had a
month.
Friend growing up that used to work for, and I had an uncle that worked for a soda pop company.
Yeah.
It was called White Rock. They don't make it anymore. Then I had a friend in Whittier, and his dad worked for 7-Up Shasta, I think it was.
Was it?
And I think so, but he used to bring home cases and cases of the...
Like 24 casers or whatever?
Yeah, he sold them out of his garage.
Oh, that's cool.
But some of the cans weren't all the way filled up. It's you know, I would hope that Anheuser-Busch does the same thing. You know?
I bet they do. They have some kind of loyalty thing or whatever.
I mean, if I went to work for a beer company or a soda pop company or whatever, I would want to be able to utilize the product, you know? I mean,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
I'm a firm believer, like, if you work for Chevy,
you should get a
hookup. You should drive a Chevy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you're working for a Chevy dealership and you're driving a Ford,
if you work for Coca-Cola, you should
be drinking a Coca-Cola product.
You should be supporting what you
I would fire somebody that was drinking a Pepsi in my place.
You don't bite the hand that feeds you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I would agree that they should be fired.
No, 100%.
If the employees aren't behind the product,
you don't need to be here.
Yeah.
You don't need to be here. Yeah. If you don't believe in what we're selling, yeah. So
that's why I own Elgin Street Sweepers.
Those bastards. Moving right along here. I can say that. You can't. I can. You might get in trouble, but not me. Here we go. Last fact of the Just the Facts segment. And this is marketing and just ingenuity at its finest in the entertainment industry. So from 1937 to 1953, NBC's Today Show had a chimpanzee co-host named J. Fred Muggs. And it is estimated that he brought in the network around $100 million.
And they never paid him a damn banana.
He worked for peanuts, man.
He worked for bananas and what do they call that?
Chimpanzees eat peanuts, too, man.
Indentured servitude?
Yeah.
Indentured
servitude. I bet they took care of him, though.
Well, yeah, I'm sure they did. I mean,
that's a great gig for a chimpanzee. Think about it.
I bet
he never went hungry or anything, man.
No, I'm sure he did. I did see it. I thought those stations all still had chimpanzees working at them. Guys that they have now.
Yeah.
Those talking heads are no brighter than a monkey.
So, all right, folks, we're going to go to our next break and we will be back with the topic of the day. Stay tuned and we will be right back in just a minute.
trying to do? You ruined my record, man. I just bought it.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, and it is time to get right into today's topic of the show. And we're kind of rehashing an old idea here, and I don't want to say rehashing. I mean...
revisiting.
Yeah, revisiting. So, like we did, much like we did with the Cobra Kai episode, you're going to see us revisiting some old topics because, you know what, sometimes it's just good to come back after a little while and see and discuss these. And today we have an article from youdiscovermusic.com, and it's actually about the 25... best live albums, 25 classics that make you feel like you were there.
The best, the 20, all 25 of them, huh?
Well, there's some. I kind of glanced at this a little bit this morning while getting some show prep together, and there's some pretty good ones on here, man. Oh, I didn't go through all of them. I wanted it to be a surprise,
I'm going to assume.
Yes.
This is a multi-genre coverage.
I would assume from what I saw mainly. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So we're not going to say the 25 greatest death metal albums.
No, live death metal. But you know, and that's one.
Remember Man of War's live at Pismo Beach?
Yeah, that's one thing I wanted. I don't have the Tokyo tapes.
I don't own the Tokyo tapes, man.
That's one thing I wanted to make clear in the beginning of this is like because we got so much like not backlash or anything, but we got so many comments on the first one we did. This is like one of our very first episodes we ever did. I think.
Yeah, it's nice to come back and redo them when you have the better quality too.
Yeah, the better audio quality and equipment. So,
and we're smarter now because time has passed.
Well, no, one thing I wanted to mention is, you know, we got hit up by so many people on comments and text and stuff like that that were like, oh, you left out this album, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, man, just so disclaimer, we're going to forget some, okay?
Yeah. Or we don't consider the album that you like worthy of being on the list. So,
and if you have any suggestions or anything, send them our way.
You listen to shit music. What do you want me to say?
Well, you know, just send them our way. Let's see what you're talking about. So... let's get right into it here, man.
I didn't know George Michael's had a live album.
Well, come on. Seriously. You realize this is my show, right? Like, we don't talk about those things. All right, so number 25, great band. I've actually had this album before. Humble Pie, performance, Rockin' the Fillmore, 1971.
It looks like the only thing Frampton could really strike gold was live stuff,
right? Like, that was his thing, man.
That was his forte, man.
So this live double album from English blues rock band Humble Pie was recorded over 2 days in May 1970.
San Francisco, right?
Yep, the Fillmore East... Hey. Let me do the show.
I was just trying to remember the record.
So it was recorded, because it wasn't in San Francisco, it was in Manhattan.
It's Fillmore East, okay.
Yeah, Fillmore East Club in Manhattan, which closed a month later after this album was recorded there. Humble Pie were made up of singer and guitarist Steve Marriott, Peter Frampton, and Greg Ridley, and drummer Jerry Shirdley. So, best-selling single from the album was I Don't Need No Doctor, which had been a hit for Ray Charles in 1966. I did not know that.
I didn't know it was a cover either. I don't know much about Humble Pie, though, man. So Fillmore East was the Manhattan one, and Fillmore West was the San Francisco one, right?
Yes. So, and then here's an interesting fact. Just before this album was released in November of 1971, Frampton left the band before this album came out.
I remember hearing that he had departed before that album came out.
So going on to number 24 here, Cream, Wheels of Fire, 1968. Now, I know I've never heard this album before. I'm not a big Cream fan, though.
No.
It's another double album. So here's the thing, man. It's a double album, which something just clicked into my mind here, man. All these claims of like Live Bullet and Kiss Alive being the first double live albums are just complete bullshit now.
Well, people were making live records, man.
But I mean, double live, they always used to say, those were the first two double live albums. This one was in 1968, and it was a double live album.
Yeah.
The one before that was 1971.
Oh, yeah.
Seeger and Kiss, Gene, Paul, you guys are liars. I'm calling you out now.
Maybe they were saying these are the first double live albums to have captured the success.
I guess.
I don't know how successful that record was.
Yeah.
I'm sure it probably was.
Well, anyways, this one was also recorded at the Winterland Ballroom in Fillmore West, which are in San Francisco.
Okay, I knew there was a Fillmore West.
Absolutely. So, and that was with Jack Bruce, Eric Clapton, and Ginger Baker.
They're all alive still, right?
Not sure on this.
I think they are.
Ginger Baker still alive?
I think so.
Okay. Well, anyways, that was Cream's live album. That was 1968. It features, I think it has like a 16-minute jam session on it and stuff like that.
Oh, all that stuff did back then.
Yeah, exactly. That's that kind of stuff. So, number 23, moving right along here, because we got to cover some ground here, man. These are a lot to cover. We're not going to spend a ton of time on them each, you know?
Yeah, okay.
So, 23, Rush, Exit Stage Left, 1981.
Great album.
Yeah?
Yeah, came right on the heels of Moving Pictures.
Yeah, about a few months afterwards, probably.
It was probably that tour they recorded it, yeah.
So, Exit Stage Left was put together around the world, recorded in Scotland and Canada, and edited and mixed in France. This is Rush's second live album and reaffirmation of their progressive rock musical beliefs. You know, on the liner notes, it says, "We didn't change. Everybody else did."
You know, I'm a very casual Rush fan. So, I mean, yeah. I'm really only into the hits that they did.
Mm-hmm.
But just because it's really not my type of music. Says, but,
you know, they have Closer to the Heart, Red Barchetta, mm-hmm. Beneath, Between and Behind, Jacob's Ladder. Alex Lifeland that's probably the band at their peak right there. Oh, I would imagine.
I don't know if they ever had a downtime.
The album reached number 6 in the UK and was certified platinum in America after selling 1 million copies.
Oh yeah, I remember when the record came out.
Yeah, oh yeah. The next one, here's a good one. I actually had this album too. Number 22, Motorhead, No Sleep Till Hammersmith. That was in 1981. That is a kick-ass album. Heavy metal album. These guys claim it's one of the best live albums from the heavy metal era.
So, I agree.
Sleep Till Hammersmith is Lemmy Kilmister, Fast Eddie Clark, and Filthy Phil Taylor.
They're all
on
dead.
Drums. Yeah, the whole original lineup has passed on.
Yep.
It's unfortunate.
Yeah, sad.
But Motorhead kind of made it cool to be punk rock and heavy metal at the same time.
They kind of were.
They bridged
crossing.
That gap.
Yeah, they were. Because when I was a kid in high school, Motorhead was considered metal punk.
It was cool to listen to.
They could walk both sides of it. It's to where you didn't have the big divide between the...
You couldn't be a punker and be like, I like Iron Maiden and shit.
Well, you could. I mean, a lot of people that like punk like Maiden, man, but you couldn't be a punk rocker like a TSOL
guy or something like that.
I'm a huge...
Yeah.
Poison fan, too, or
Kiss
something.
Kiss fan or any of that shit.
Yeah, I guess.
It was against all that.
Till later.
Then it was like, hey, yeah, exactly. Number 21, this is kind of interesting to see this high up on the list. Led Zeppelin, The Song Remains the Same,
Jesus.
1976.
Jeez, yeah.
What?
You ever heard the album?
Why?
It's a very, very long album.
Is it?
Yeah.
3 years after live tapes had been made at Madison Square Garden during Zeppelin's record-breaking 1973 tour, Jimmy Page went into the studio to mix the songs for this release. The album was released alongside the film of the concert. I've seen parts of the film. It's kind of crazy.
It's nuts, yeah.
But yeah, so there's a 29-minute version of Dazed and Confused. Now I see what you're talking about.
It's a long record, dude. I remember that song.
That's a lot of vinyl, man.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. I would figure that would be higher up on the list.
It's a pretty boring record, man.
Oh, you want to talk about boring records? Here comes another one. And I know this band has legions of fans, and they're very dedicated followers. The Grateful Dead come in at number 20. With Live Dead at 1969.
Yeah, that part's probably
one of the most successful touring groups of the 60s.
Well, it's got to be one of them. They toured all the way into the 80s.
That's what I mean.
They toured until the guy dropped dead, man.
Yeah,
I'm
assuming,
Jerry Barry's dead, okay?
Yeah, I'm not a huge Dead fan.
No,
but,
why would you be?
Well, I don't do a ton of acid and stuff, so moving right along, number 19. There's another band I'm not a super huge fan of. I know you're a fan of them, and you probably know this album. U2, Under a Blood Red Sky, 1983.
I'm not familiar with that particular. I didn't know that was a live album. Mm-hmm. I'm familiar. I saw the movie that they did, and I like the album, the soundtrack, the Rattle and Hum.
Mm-hmm.
It's good. It's a good one. But I didn't know Under a Blood Red Sky was a live record.
Under a Blood Red Sky, live at Red Rocks, merits its reputation as one of the seminal concerts in U2's nearly 50-year career.
Yeah.
It was recorded at Red Rocks Amphitheater in Colorado on June 1983.
Let's check that out.
The concert came after torrential downpours and all that, and despite the conditions, the band still went on.
Yeah, well, if you've never seen U2 live, I mean, like I said, I'm a casual fan at best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've seen them 3 times.
Yeah.
And they are mesmerizing, to be honest.
So
Bono is a god, man.
Here's one that's really, and you were here at this one, 1985, and this comes in at number 18. Iron Maiden, Live
the Long
After
Beach
Death.
One.
Live After
Yeah,
Death.
That's a good one. That's a good album. Great album.
Live album from 1985. The whole thing is just fucking awesome.
Well, the show was phenomenal.
You know, yeah, and just
I got to see it on Sunday night.
That whole time period of Iron Maiden, they saw 4 nights in Long Beach.
Yeah,
radio coverage.
I was going to say, a lot of people didn't realize this. Back in the KNAC days and stuff in California, growing up there and all that, Iron Maiden didn't even get played on those stations.
Yeah, they weren't a radio band.
You know,
yeah.
They just nowadays with the XM radio and stuff, you hear them quite a bit,
and you hear Run to the Hills and stuff like that. Yeah, or you might hear Number of the Beast.
You hear a little bit deeper cuts every now and then. You know,
but I'm talking terrestrial. You hear some terrestrial radio a little bit
because
I used to play it on comp all the time.
Yeah, but I mean,
like I said, I would play Number of the Beast or Run to the Hills, stuff like that.
What was neat about that time period, or that tour that they did on, it was the Power Slave tour that they were on. So it was an all Egyptian themed set that they did at the same time. Dio was touring on, I want to say it was the Last in Line album, and he had an Egyptian theme, and I got to see both those shows.
Yeah.
And now Iron Maiden's was way more decorated. But Dio had a badass pyramid and all that,
We got
too.
To see the Somewhere
Back in Time?
No, that's the original tour. It was the, whatever the tour was, Somewhere Lost in Time, whatever the fuck it was. Yeah. They did a rehash of all the Power Sleeve shit and all that in 2007. We saw that tour a few times.
Yeah, that was a good show. A
couple shows on that tour.
They're always good.
Well, yeah, Iron Maiden's just, they're absolute pros to begin with, but I do notice on Live After Death, all the songs are really sped up. It's the adrenaline, totally.
Well, I think they had to fit it all onto to make it.
You know, but it's really sped up when you
on the version of Running Free on that record.
Yeah,
where he does the crowd in participation.
Yeah,
that's the night I was there.
All the banter
on Sunday night. Yeah, I was there on Sunday night.
Yep. So number 17. I'm not a big MC5 fan, but they put out an album called Kick Out the Jams in 1969, and They were an American proto-punk band, MC5, and this was recorded live because Elektra Records A&R chief Danny Fields believed that it would be the best way of capturing the band's energy and excitement on record. You know what? That usually happens with a lot of bands that are great live bands.
Yeah.
They always have to go, we need to do a live album to actually capture what we sound like and who we are.
Yeah, a lot of bands, it's an artist like Bob Seger.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, not that Bob's later studio albums were good, you know, but if you listen to his early studio stuff, the albums that made the album Live Bullet, they're not terrible, they're just very weak.
So absolutely, they don't have the energy.
Yeah, the live and you know, a lot of people got to realize that live albums are doctored.
They are too. Exactly. And they're not always recorded where they say they are. No. And stuff
and most of them are regardless. Yeah, but regardless, they're still good.
Yeah. So the number 16 comes in, it's called The Band with The Last Waltz, 1978.
I remember that record.
You do? Yeah. So that Martin Scorsese's The Last Waltz is one of the most immaculately filmed rock concerts in history, and the film and double album preserves the final appearance of The Band. You know, so you know who they are. I've never heard of this.
I know of The Band. I don't know much about them.
Gotcha. So the group was fronted by Robbie Robertson, that had toured with Bob Dylan for 16 years. And the concert was held at San Francisco's Winterland Ballroom, which a ton of famous concerts have been shot there.
Yeah, everything that was on the West Coast. That's why,
Don't know much about that one, but moving right along to number 15.
But if you like it, you like it.
Yeah, moving right along to number 15, Lynyrd Skynyrd, One More From the Road.
Great record.
1976.
Great record.
So this is Skynyrd's first live album, and was released a year before the plane crash that killed the lead singer and songwriter Ronnie Van Zant.
That's the first Lynyrd Skynyrd record I ever heard.
Was it?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, my brother had that live album.
Yeah.
And that's the one where they do Freebird on it, and he says, play it pretty for Atlanta on there. It's a great record, man.
Wow.
From what I remember, you know.
Yeah, so, that's probably capturing Skynyrd at what they really were,
peak. Yeah, they were a great live band. Their guitar players were amazing.
Now, number 14, moving along, actually had this album. Actually, I had the Made in Europe album, not Made in Japan, but this one they've listed as Made in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Number 14, Deep Purple, Made in Japan, 1972.
This is the Ian Gillan years, right?
Recordings of three concerts in Osaka and Tokyo in August of 1972, and they were all put onto a live double album, Made in Japan. It's Ian Gillan, Richie Blackmore, John Lord, Roger Glover, and Ian Paice.
Yeah, what a lineup, huh, for a band.
Yeah, so, I mean, that had Smoke on the Water and all that stuff, a 20-minute version of Space Truckin', and, that's what bands
Deep
did.
Deep Purple did that stuff. Yeah. They go into those keys, they put them keyboardists in them bands.
On them LSD.
And it just goes off from there, man.
So, I had the Deep Purple Made in Europe one that had David Coverdale fronting the band.
Yeah, I was going to say, it must have been something that was cool, they did.
Yeah.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think Made in Japan was like the one of the first rock and roll records that was recorded in Asia.
I would imagine, like, by
Budokan and everything came after
that. Oh, yeah, I would imagine, yeah, probably. Yeah.
The Japanese love that music, man.
So we're just going to skip the next one completely because I know you don't like reggae.
You'll see a live reggae show. Yeah,
it's Bob Marley and the Wailers live, 1975.
If you're a Bob Marley fan, more power to you, man. I'm just not a big reggae guy either,
but, you know, more power to him. My next one. Love this album. I bought this album at Record City in Las Vegas, Nevada for $8. I still have it, the original one that I bought, with the booklet and everything inside of it. It's Cheap Trick. Cheap Trick at Budokan.
Absolutely.
1978.
Japanese, yeah. I bought that album when it was new, too.
At Budokan was the first commercial breakthrough for the Chicago quartet Cheap Trick, confirming them as one of the best live bands of the 70s. I absolutely agree to that.
You know what I like a lot about this record? This you're talking about Cheap Trick at Budokan? That's what we're talking about here?
Yeah.
What I like a lot
about
it.
Lay it on me, man.
Lay it on me. Is I bought that record.
Yeah.
Brand new at the Woolworth in La Mirada, California. And I think a few weeks later is when Heaven Tonight came out.
Yeah.
Which was another successful record for him.
Big, yeah.
Yeah, and one of the things I always liked about that album there, that Live at Budokan record there.
It had stuff from Heaven Tonight on it.
Well, it's got Surrender on it, and I just like the way he always opened that song up.
Yeah.
He goes, this is off our new album. It just came out this week, and it's called Surrender, and they go do-do-do-do into the music. I just thought it was awesome.
Oh, yeah.
And they have a great opening on that album, too.
Hello there.
Yeah, and they close it with goodbye there.
Yeah.
It's hello there, and then the end is like, good night now, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. No, that's a high energy album.
Everything in between is complete garbage.
It's got some high energy songs. Yeah,
Buns did
some great drum work on that album too.
I miss Moody Carlos, man. I wish he'd come back.
So here's the next one at number 11. I don't know if you know this one. I'm not a big Neil Young fan, but I know he's
Russ Never Sleeps.
Yeah, he's very popular. So Neil Young and Crazy Horse Live Rust, 1979, recorded in October 78 at Cow Palace in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Live Rust was originally released as a double album and was the soundtrack to the concert film documenting Neil Young's Rust Never Sleeps.
Mm-hmm.
Young is no stranger to concert recordings, but Live Rust is probably is one of his best, is what they're claiming. So
that's got one of the baddest ass songs on it ever written. Yeah, Out of the Blue and Into the Black.
Oh yeah,
you know they did two versions of it. I know I'm going to get this wrong.
Oh, yeah?
Into the Blue and Out of the Black and Out of the Black and Into the Blue. One is an acoustic version of it.
Wow.
You know the song. He's like, this is the story of a Johnny Rotten.
That's right.
I freaking love the rock version of that song. It's badass, man.
Okay.
The studio one is kind of, the acoustic one is kind of
I did not know that. Okay, well, moving right along here. Another immensely popular 70s rock band, Thin Lizzy, number 10, Live and Dangerous.
That was a big one.
Was it? 1978. Yeah. So after their Bad Reputation album reached number 4 in the UK, top 10 in 1977, they decided a live album was the way to go. And they, you know, Phil Lynott, Rest in Paradise and all that. This album was also a big hit, and U2 also claims this album is a big early influence to them.
Oh, I imagine it would be, yeah. But a lot of people don't realize is Thin Lizzy was a big influence to a lot of rock bands, and they had a lot bigger following than people realize.
Who played, was a guest musician, with credited as the harmonica on this. He's credited as Bluesy Lewis.
Probably Tom Petty.
Huey Lewis.
That's right. I heard that.
That's nuts, man. Yeah. That's cool. He was friends with those guys.
Well, he was probably a young musician at the time. I mean, he is a harmonica player, man.
Oh, and a good one,
And you come to think about it, Tom Petty's not even a harmonica player.
I don't know.
He faked it in that video. I remember reading about
it. That's hilarious. He didn't even really play it, man.
He's going to play a little rock and
roll. All right, so let's move on here.
That's my impersonation of Tom Petty.
Yeah, we're getting down to the last nine here.
Well, he's laying on me, Andy.
You don't have any drugs, do you?
You don't happen to have any drugs on you, do you?
Number 9, Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison. Now, this is obviously a world-famous one. I have. Not anymore, but I did. Johnny Cash's concert at Folsom State Prison in California on the 13th of January, 1968, is one of the best live albums in country music.
Okay.
It has... I'm reading an article.
I agree with you. Okay.
This guy. See how difficult he is to work with?
I agree. I'm agreeing with you.
His, you know, so they did this for the prisoners, man, because Johnny had been arrested and stuff.
You know, I always thought, and someone had to correct me eventually about it, is when he did the Folsom album, when I heard about the Folsom album that he did, and I thought he was
in jail,
in prison. Yeah. It turns out he wasn't. He was just doing shows.
Yeah.
Bands do that. I mean, bands do prison shows. I
didn't. Comedians do it, too.
Yeah, it's kind of weird.
Yep. So... It included his hit 1955 song, Folsom Prison Blues. You know, it's talking about murder.
I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die.
I guess, yeah. Cold bastard.
Are you a Johnny Cash fan?
Kind of. I like his hits and stuff, you know, but...
Yeah, I don't know many of them. I mean, I know a lot of people like him.
Yeah.
I like the one he does about the boy named Sue.
Yeah.
I, for some reason, that song always stuck in my craw.
Now, the next one here, number eight, this one catches me kind of off guard. Talking Heads, Stop Making Sense, 1984,
was it? Oh, yeah. Yeah, David Byrne was, and still is, a very talented musician, man. I mean...
So you know, they said the single off of this is Psycho Killer.
Mm-hmm.
Is it
Psycho Killers?
Oh, that's it, the Talking Killers. Heads, huh?
Yeah, that's the Talking Heads, and then they did
Take Me to the River.
As the days go by, muddy water running high.
Yeah, it says Take Me to the River.
Yeah, Take Me to the River.
Oh, wow, okay. Yeah,
you know some Talking Heads stuff.
All right, well, now let's move right along to number seven, because we're going to have to cover this for a second here.
Wait, we didn't like the other one?
as an honorary musician.
Oh, San Francisco's Music Society. Mr. Peter Frampton.
That's Cameron Crowe, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe it is him doing that.
On the credits, I think.
Because I know he did the little blurb on the back of I'm in You was Cameron Crowe. They've been friends a long time. People that don't know who Cameron Crowe is, Cameron Crowe was an editor for Rolling Stone magazine. The movie Almost Famous is about him. He wrote Jerry Maguire.
Yeah.
He's done a couple of... He wrote Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Yeah. But number seven, Peter Frampton with Frampton Comes Alive. I think, like Wayne said, I think every kid in the suburbs got one of these.
I still have the record. Yeah, I still own the album, man.
1976.
If you lived in the suburbs, it was required that you listen to this record.
And like Frampton said on the album, you know, we'd like to get a bit funky now. That's the whole album.
It's probably, to this day, one of those albums that you can put on
front to back.
Front to back and not worry about it. And you never really get sick of hearing it.
No, not at all. And even the common songs off of it are still great. Like, you don't really, I don't change the channel when Show Me the Way comes on and stuff.
No, it's Peter Frampton.
And it's got some deeper cuts on it that are pretty cool too, you know? I Want to Go to the Sun and stuff.
See,
and
when people say deeper cuts on that record, I don't really relate to it because I've loved the album for so long. It's all so common to me.
But if you were into Frampton's studio stuff and heard, exactly. And
another that we were talking about earlier. If you listen to stuff off of Frampton's Camel.
If you think about it, a lot of bands from the 70s and 80s got like that situation. Yeah. Like, hey, we got to put out a live album. It really did as well.
Kiss
is
the same way.
Oh, totally. It captured everything. Bob Seger, Frampton, Kiss.
Cream?
Yeah, obviously. Frampton. It's all he does is live stuff now. So that spent 97 weeks in the charts. Following its release, and it's regarded as one of the best live albums of all time.
Yeah, I would agree with, and he took number seven. That's probably fair. I'd probably put it a little higher. But
Frampton was 26 years old at the time when it came out.
He was a young guy, man.
Yeah, so he did.
He's done now.
Yeah,
he's all done now. He's retired.
So one thing I wanted to say is that Frampton's album, this album, was always considered the best-selling live album of all time. Until a few years ago, it was surpassed by Garth Brooks' double live album.
Hopefully that album's on there.
Yeah, which it should be. I would hope so. Album, it should probably be up closer to the top three, probably. Yeah.
Good album. If you're a Garth Brooks fan, I mean, you know.
Here's another one. This is kind of random. This man, very, very wild, very outlandish, probably up there with Little Richard for probably as paving the way for like rock singers and stuff, you know, the attitude and the vocal style. James Brown and the Famous Flames, Live at the Apollo, 1963.
Okay.
So, James, you got to give him credit, man.
Hey, man, yeah, he was probably phenomenal live.
That's what I mean. But James and those guys, Little Richard, those are the guys that really paved the way for the have guys like David Lee Roth and
probably,
Paul Stanley.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some
stuff
truth
like
to that,
that
man,
you know.
Yeah. Did they ever bury James?
I believe they did.
The last time we looked a few months ago, he was still in a refrigerator at
his
daughter's
house. That's insane, man. That's just crazy.
Well, there was a bunch of issues. They were going to put him on tour or something.
But they say that this is James at his top form.
I'm sure it is, yeah.
I like James. I have to check that out. James at the Apollo. Live.
Living in America.
He's a high on PCP in that interview.
He was high on something.
On something, yeah. Just singing lyrics, dude. It's great. Number five. You wanted the best. You got the best. Kiss. Alive, 1975. Right. Now, in my opinion, it would be Alive, too.
I'm not going to get into this. I'm not going to get into this.
Just
going
to give a little shout-out to John Jansen out there.
I like the second Alive album, Kiss Alive 2, a lot better than I like the Alive album.
But
the Alive album was huge for
Kiss.
This
is truly the album that made them rock and roll superstars. It climbed to top 10, and its accompanying single, Rock and Roll Night, the live version, made it to number 12. So, I mean, it's everything that you want as a Kiss fan. If somebody came to me and was like, hey, I want to start listening to Kiss, what would you give me? I'd give them Kiss Alive and Kiss Alive 2.
I'd give them double platinum.
You know, and probably Kiss Alive 3, because that covers the whole gist of it.
I love Kiss Alive 3.
I thought it was a great album.
Yeah, I did too. They did
some 80s stuff.
I didn't care much for the one they did with the orchestra.
It was unique, whatever.
They're just not that kind of a band.
No, either was Metallica to me, you know. But Scorpions didn't do bad with it.
It was just weird.
Yeah, it was just they kind of adjusted to do it, but... Kiss Alive, great album. All the Kiss Live albums, I'll take them. All right, number four, I'm just going to glaze over here because I really don't like this era of music or this band to begin with.
No.
Nirvana, MTV Unplugged in New York. It was a hugely successful album and popular, but I don't really like the guy, so...
I think he's making the best music he ever made right now.
Well, I think him doing what he did made him as big as he is.
That's a whole different subject. I like the kid that came from there, man.
I discussed this with Gene Simmons, dude, when I interviewed him, and he said it perfectly. He was like, Nirvana had two albums.
He's right. They did. That's all they had, two albums.
He's like, you go ahead. You name me more people from that time period that were legendary status, you know, as rock bands or whatever. They were single-handedly responsible for killing rock and roll.
Hey, and you ain't got to sell me on hating Nirvana. I've done it. I've hated it my whole life.
And to me, I know we're going to catch a bunch of shit for this, but I don't really care. My show. but as far as grunge goes, I mean, I'm a heavy metal guy and stuff and all that, and just rock and roll in general. I think bands like Alice in Chains were cool and stuff, but they were part of that time period too, but they were more metal to me. They weren't like grunge.
I'm going
to
give you a little note. I lived through that era.
It was garbage.
It was horrible.
Absolutely.
I don't care what anybody says.
No, I believe it. Yeah.
In my opinion, there has been two good bands that have come out of Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
One is Heart and one is Queensryche.
Okay.
One of the things I do like about
Heart,
Nirvana,
for sure, too.
Is the fact that they produced David Grohl, who seems to be a pretty good guy. Man.
Yeah, a decent human being.
I never cared. When I read the story about Kurt Cobain spitting on Elton John's piano
because
he thought Axl Rose was playing it next, and the petty stuff that he did like that, I never considered Kurt Cobain as being all that talented.
He seemed like an asshole.
And as a human being, Paul Stanley nailed it the most. This guy would come out in his dirty clothes and his raggy shoes while he had millions of dollars in the banks and talk about how
bad
crummy it is.
Yeah.
To me...
Hey, the butler didn't show up today.
Yeah, hey, my butler didn't show up and my Bentley didn't start, you know? It's all a matter of opinion. To me, the grunge era...
It was terrible.
Is worse. It was the worst era of music that ever came out, and I'm including disco. I would rather listen to disco over that.
That's a tall order.
That's how bad it was for me.
You know what, though? I can agree, because at least some of the disco stuff was actual talent.
You had the Bee Gees. You had Barry Gibb.
Heatwave and shit. Those guys were playing bass and shit and drums and stuff.
I never found one.
And I will agree with you. Thank God for Dave Grohl coming out of that whole shit.
I never found one appealing.
And no disrespect to him or any of the work he did in that group.
No. The drumming was the most talented thing in the band. You know, people say,
and it proves, look how much further he got.
Well, people say Kurt Cobain was this phenomenal guitar player. He wasn't. He was a very basic guitar player. You know, and
I hate when people say that, because it's
and you know what? And if you take their bass player, what was his name and where is he at now?
Yeah, well, he's known, but you just don't know.
No, but I just not
moving
not
to, on. We gotta go.
Yeah, let's go to the
number
next
three.
We've vented enough.
Yeah, Rolling Stones, get your yayas out. The Rolling Stones in concert, 1970. It was recorded on the 27th and 28th of November in 1969 in Baltimore and New York's Madison Square Garden too. So it was recorded in two different places, but most live albums
are. And that
had
to have been their very first live album.
Yeah, and I you know what? I've never really listened to the Rolling Stones live albums, you know, to be honest. I'm more of a fan of their studio stuff.
I got to see them last year, about a year ago.
They changed the songs live
2 years
stuff.
Ago. Yeah, that's one of the things you always... Actually, they didn't do that when we seen them. I only got to stay about half the show because it was summertime, and it was really, really hot in the arena, and we were really, really high up. And the smell of pot was so bad, it was making me nauseous. And I think I had too much to drink before I went there. You know, so it was a perfect combination where I wasn't comfortable at the concert. You know, so I took off. But the half of the show I did see, it was phenomenal. It was great.
Right on. Moving right along to number two so we can wrap this up here. We're getting a little short on time. Allman Brothers Band at Fillmore East. Look how many live albums are recorded at the Fillmores, East and West.
Now, I never heard that one.
Yeah.
But my brother had a live Allman Brothers Band that it was called A Dollar a Gas. Clean the windshields, check the tires, and a dollar's worth of gas. It was something like that. I could be
along
wrong.
Along the lines, yeah.
And it had Ramblin' Man on.
Oh, okay.
Lord, I Was Born a Ramblin' Man. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. That's the song. It had that. It was a great album.
Yeah,
from what I remember, very long.
It's kind of weird how they're wrapping this up. So the very last one at number one is The Who, Live at Leeds, 1970.
Everybody is
not a big Who fan,
but that album has got acclaims from.
Oh, I'm sure it has. But real quick before we wrap up here, I wrote my own top five albums, and they touched on some of these already. So I'll just run through them real quick and not touch on them too much. Number five, Kiss Alive. Number four, Live Bullet or Nine Tonight from Bob Seger. Either one, great albums.
You put those albums on the
together.
Same
yeah,
level.
Yeah, they're about great. They're both great.
Second one better.
Number three, Frampton Comes Alive.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, it's a tie between Live After Death and Rising in the East with Judas Priest. As far as two live heavy metal albums go, you really can't beat them. And number one, Kiss Alive 2. That's what got me into rock and roll in general, so I have to have... That's always number one on my list.
Yeah, I think if I was going to pull five random live albums that I wanted to say that were my favorite, I would definitely throw the live Huey or the live Garth album on there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's just put it at number five because there's nowhere else to go. If you're a Huey... Or Huey Lewis is on the album, actually. He does a song with him on it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why I keep reverting back to Huey Lewis. Then number
Working
four...
Working for a living, right?
Number four, I would say probably... You would have to give credit. If I was going to pick a live Judas Priest record, I know the one you picked is the later material, mm-hmm. but I like the original one, the Unleashed in the East.
Yeah.
I would do that. And then Scorpions, Worldwide Live.
That's a good one.
Which is another good one, you know. And then I would probably go, I like Tokyo Tapes or Tokyo Dome from Van Halen.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I would take as a really good live album. Then my number one live album... I would have to go with Frampton Comes Alive just because I'm so familiar with it, you know, and
it's been
around so long. But now to do my favorite Kiss album would obviously be Kiss Alive.
Oh, yeah. But I get what you're saying. Yeah.
And then I also another honorable mention I would give to is the Las Vegas record that I got from Olivia Newton-John, her live album.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
It's a well-done record, man.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. Like, we're not excluding any, you know, it's not just rock or whatever. No. You can...
There was a live...
Because there's Elvis records that I love that are live from Vegas like that.
There was one
that
of my
awesome.
Siblings had a live Helen Reddy, not Helen Reddy.
The Vegas years. I'll take the Cleaver, man.
Who's the other lady that sang real pretty? Linda Ronstadt. So they had a live album, which it was really good.
Back when the Eagles were backing her?
No. This was they'd already split and gone their own ways. It wasn't the Stone Ponies or nothing anymore. Yeah. So.
Well, you got any final thoughts before we get out of here, man?
You know what? I hope bands keep making live records, man. Because I mean, this day and age, it's you know what? The Madonna live album was a good live album too.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, so.
Never heard it, man.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure she did a live album.
Oh, I guarantee there's got to be one out there.
You know what? Make it a point to go out and find some artists that you...
Hey, and if you know of any good live albums that we think we might like, send them our way.
Yeah, that we
go
might
ahead.
Have missed. Yeah,
get absolutely. At us and check us out on all social media. You can find me, Andrew Taylor, on Instagram at Andrew Taylor Radio. And you can find the show on Facebook at In The Round AZ. And you can find Lee on Facebook at Lee Tonin. And we'd like to thank you for tuning in today. And we'll be back, guys, with another episode of In The Round with Andrew Taylor and Lee. Thank you, and have a great night. No